So we're reading this evening from Bhagavad Gita as it is, Srila Prabhupada's translation and purports to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 11, text 34, called the universal form Virat Rupa. Virat Rupa Yoga. I don't remember what it's called. Okay, let's chant together. Dronam cha bhishmam cha jayadratham cha. Dronam cha bhishmam cha jayadratham cha. Karnam tatanyan api yodhavira. Karnam tatanyan api yodhavira. Maya hatang stang jahima vyatishta. Maya hatang stvam jahi ma vyatishta. Yudhyasvajetasi arane sapatna. Yudhyasvajetasi arane sapatna. Dronam cha bhishmam cha jayadratham cha. Karnam tatanyan api yodhavira. Maya hatang stvam jahi ma vyatishta. Yudhyasva jitasi rane sapatna. Amcha. Also Drona. Bhishmamcha. Also Bhishma. Jayadrathamcha. Also Jayadratha. Karnam, guess who? Karna. Tata, also. Anyan, others. Api, certainly. Yodhaviran, great warriors. Maya, by me. Hatan. Actually, it's Hatan, and then by Sunday it becomes Hatongs. Hatan, already killed. Tum, you. Jahi, destroy. Ma, do not. Vyatishta, be disturbed. Yudhyasva, just fight. Jeta asi, you will conquer. Rane, in the fight. Sapatnan, enemies. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, I see. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Translation: Drona, Bhishma, Jayadratha, Karna, and the other great warriors have already been destroyed by me. Therefore, kill them and do not be disturbed. Simply fight, and you will vanquish your enemies in battle. Purport. Every plan is made by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but He is so kind and merciful to His devotees that He wants to give the credit to His devotees who carry out His plan according to his desire. Life should therefore move in such a way that everyone acts in Krishna consciousness and understands the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the medium of a spiritual master. The plans of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are understood by his mercy, and the plans of the devotees are as good as his plans. One should follow such plans and be victorious in the struggle for existence. And so ends Srila Prabhupada's purport. Dronang cha vishmang cha jayadratang cha karnang tatanyan api yodhaviran mayahatang stung jahi ma vyatishta yudhyasva jetasi rane sapatnan. Drona, Bhishma, Jayadratha, Karna, and the other great warriors have already been destroyed by me. Therefore, kill them and do not be disturbed. Simply fight, and you will vanquish your enemies in battle. All right. We have this revelation, Krishna's universal form that's sometimes called Virat Rupa. Virat, the word, means many things. It can just mean sovereign, meaning lordly. Comes from, actually the word is viraj or viraj, and then it becomes virat in compound. And this is of course the very famous section of the Bhagavad Gita where some interpreters say this is the climax of the Bhagavad Gita. This is the high point of the Bhagavad Gita, because this is where Krishna is showing himself for who he really is. I remember years ago there was a professor at my university, visiting professor, gave a lecture on Bhagavad Gita. Actually, he was coming to the university as an aspiring person to be hired at that university. And he was one of three competitors. And each of the competitors was asked to give a lecture as if they would be giving a lecture to undergraduates, you know, younger students. But the audience was all professors and graduate students, except me. I was an undergraduate. Anyway, he gave this lecture on Bhagavad Gita, 11th chapter. And this is the point I remember him making, and I was feeling a little disappointed. He didn't get the job, by the way. Maybe Krishna didn't allow. Because he was seemed to be saying, you know, this is the real identity, whereas the form of Krishna is more a mask. And then it's like the whole Mahabharata and Bhagavad Gita, there's Krishna. But then at this point, he kind of pulls back and shows, this is who I am. Well, that is one interpretation. And the big theme within this revelation, this, what's the word I want? There's another word. Where he shows himself in this way, is the big theme is destruction. He says, I'm destroying everything. Two verses before, he says, Kalosmi lokakshayakrit pravriddha lokansamahartum iha pravriddha. Kalosmi, I am time. Lokakshayakrit, destroyer of the worlds. Pravriddha, I'm the great destroyer of the worlds. So it's interesting, though, that Krishna has another, again, this word I'm forgetting at the moment, where he shows himself like this. Before all of this happens, when he's trying to negotiate peace, and he goes to Dhritarashtra, and there's a whole scheme afoot by Duryodhana to try to arrest Krishna, try to tie him up, right? And anyway, that's foiled. And as you know, Krishna also shows himself in some sort of virat rupa at that time. But in some ways, it's the opposite of this, because in that revelation, it's more like, whereas this is destruction, showing everything, coming, he's swallowing everything, right? He's opening his big mouth, and everything comes in. In the one that he shows to Duryodhana, he's, so many emanations are coming out of him. All different forms coming out of him. So it's like a creation, and this is that's like a srishti, and this is like a nirodha. It's winding up, bringing everything back to himself. So, okay, so there's this theme of destruction, and because it's a discussion with Arjuna, and he wants to convince Arjuna to go ahead with his duty to fight, so the other theme, you could say, is reassurance. Don't worry, I'm taking care of everything. And you're just my agent. Where is that verse? It's been so long. It's here somewhere. Nimitta matram bhavasavi sachin. Or is that in the tenth? Become my instrument, Savyasachi, O left-handed one. And in this way, attain glory. Another theme is glory, because we're talking about Kshatriyas who are after fame and glory. They want glory in this world and the next, and they're prepared to die for it. That's what it means to be a Kshatriya, ready to die for glory, ready to give up this body for glory. Shishi Gorni Tai Ki Jai. So, time I am, destroyer of the worlds, he says, destruction is the theme here. And then the next verse, he says, Tasmat Tvam Utishta Yasha Lavasva. Therefore, get up, prepare to fight, and win glory. Win glory. Yasha Lavasva, Lava. Gain Yasha, fame. Doesn't sound very spiritual, does it? Well. Okay, so we're in that stage of the Mahabharata situation where all attempts at pacification, of coming to some sort of agreement, have been abandoned. Now we're standing face to face. It's us against them, and it's going to be a fight. And just at that time, when everything is ready to go, the least likely person to get shaky knees, Arjuna, the least likely person to hesitate, Arjuna, the great, famous, already glorious fighter, suddenly he stops and he can't go on. So these reassurances. And Krishna becomes particular. Dronam, Bhishmam, Jayadrata, Karna. They're all finished. Karna, of course, was the arch enemy of Arjuna from the very beginning. They were deadly enemies from the very beginning, really. The word sapatnan, if I remember correctly, it comes from sapatni, which means co-wife. And then it comes to mean enemy, because co-wives, you know, one wife, no problem. Two wives, three wives, oh, big problem. Competition. So it has come to mean enemy. Sapatni, feminine, but then in the masculine. Sapatna. And the word Rana is mentioned in the fight. Rana means fight, it means battle. And there is an interesting idea that comes again and again in the Mahabharata, that the battle of Kurukshetra is in fact a sacrifice, a yajna, Rana yajna, the sacrifice of battle. We sometimes hear about, nobody is really sure whether it was ever done as a regular practice, but there are mention of human sacrifices. We have mention in Srimad Bhagavatam an attempted human sacrifice. Who was the attempt? Who was the attempted intended victim? Jatabharata. What happened? Yes, Bhadrakali, to whom Jatabharata was supposed to be sacrificed, came bursting out of her own form, her deity form, and how did it go? Grabbed these different swords that they were going to use to kill Jatabharata, I believe, and then killed everybody who was going to kill Jatabharata. Divine justice. But the Mahabharata is a story about a human sacrifice. Big time. Human sacrifice, big time. All the soldiers, and here we get a list of some of the major ones. Help me out here, I'm forgetting now the relations. Jayadrata, who is Jayadrata? Oh, you who have been reading the Croatian Mahabharata. Oh, wait, no, you don't have a Croatian one yet. Oh, right. I'm sorry, I got confused with Poland and Polonia. Krishna Dharmas. But it's coming, right? It's coming just now. Jayadrata. No, I won't speculate. Somebody knows? Somebody's a Mahabharata buff here? Jayadrata? Did Jayadrata kill Abhimanyu? Well, it was a whole group who killed Abhimanyu, wasn't it? But maybe he was the major one. Yes, that was Jayadrata, wasn't it? Okay, so we have him placed in that respect. Jayadrata was the one that Arjuna wanted to kill after Abhimanyu had been killed on the next day. Yeah, so... So Arjuna was certainly interested to see these persons killed. Drona, Bhishma, of course, they're in a different class. They're his teachers, but that's already been discussed. In fact, he has taken blessings from Drona and Bhishma at the beginning of the fight to allow him to carry on with the fight. But I wanted to make this point about the Rana Yajna, that this is a sacrifice of human beings, and it's been explained that there will be description in later chapters and books of the Mahabharata that the fields were simply flowing with blood. And this is a sacrifice of blood to the earth goddess. Yeah. Now, we don't usually think of Bhumi in that way, but that sense is given, that Bhumi was receiving that blood and in this way also becoming pacified. Yeah. So the Mahabharata is very, very gruesome indeed. I may have mentioned last time I was here, and we had a Sunday program, we talked about the dice game. I may have mentioned at that time how there are three sacrifices in the Mahabharata. The first is the Rajasuya of Yudhishthira, in which he is trying to affirm his position as emperor, we would say. And this all led, I mean, the Rajasuya leads to the dice game, and it's been explained that technically at the end or part of the Rajasuya procedure, according to Shastra, is that the king has to perform some gambling, and he has to win in the gambling in order to make the final conclusion. Aha, even fortune, chance is on his side, so okay, then he can be the king. So therefore Yudhishthira's taking part in the gambling was simply not only that he liked to gamble, that's sometimes said, he liked to gamble and he didn't know how, but it was his duty if he was going to do the Rajasuya and complete it. So Rajasuya was one sacrifice. Then the next sacrifice was the Battle of Kurukshetra, the Rana Yagya. And then after the Rana Yagya, when everyone was dead, nobody left except the mourning women, the wives of the dead soldiers. Practically nobody left. Except King Yudhishthira with his kingdom, with nobody in the kingdom to be the master of. Then he performs what? An Ashwamedha Yajna, and this he performs as a prayaschita, as a compensation for the sins of so much killing in the battle. So that's Mahabharata. It's a very grisly story. I've been thinking about this because I've been writing an article, paper, which I'll be reading at a conference in, of all places, Dubrovnik, in a few days. There's a conference, the fourth international conference on the Sanskrit epics and Puranas, in, of all places, the Brahmin. And they've accepted my proposal for paper. And I'm essentially writing about the Bhagavatam, and it's essentially a glorification of the Bhagavatam. But it's in the form of a comparison with the Mahabharata. And again, as I mentioned before, I talked about the dice game. So I've been thinking more about the dice game. And I started thinking about it in relation to, of all things, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Rasa Leela. How do these relate? You'll have to read the paper. Well, I'll give you a clue. An interesting thing about the dice game is Krishna's absence during it. Now, we all know the story that Krishna appears when Draupadi prays for him to to appear. And then he appears in the form of a limitless sari, supposedly. That will probably come in your version of Mahabharata, but there's a general consensus that this was a later addition. In any case, we can understand the later addition, the feeling of frustration that Krishna is not there. Where was Krishna at the time? He was out fighting Shalva. Shalva was giving trouble after the death of Shishupala. So then Shalva, who was his brother, wanted to... And I think that's mentioned in the Krishna book, in the 10th canto. In any case, Krishna was gone. He was nowhere near to Hastinapur. He didn't even know about, so to say. I mean, okay, Krishna knows everything. But later on, in the Mahabharata, he says to, I think, to Draupadi, he says, if I had known that this was going to happen, I would have come immediately. I don't approve of gambling. The point is made that who was present, essentially Lord Shiva was present. Shiva is associated with destruction, he's also associated with gambling. He and Parvati have a great time gambling. They love to gamble. They love to play dice and gamble together. Radha and Krishna also play dice, but that's a little different. So Krishna was absent during that. Another time he's absent significantly is when Ashwatthama attacks the camp of the Pandavas, of the Panchalas, including the Pandavas, all who were left on the Pandavas side were in a camp after the battle. And at one point Ashwatthama goes into this completely mad frenzy just that night, and he prays to Lord Shiva to help him to massacre everyone else, and Lord Shiva grants his prayer. And he goes to the camp, and he's so empowered, he can pass by all the guards, enter in, and, I mean, literally, he just butchers in the most gruesome and horrible way the sons of Draupadi and so many others. Who was absent then? Krishna. Just before that evening, Krishna said to a few of his friends and the Pandavas also, he said, I don't think it's going to be auspicious to be here tonight. Let's go out. Let's go out on the town. let's get out of here. So he was out of the picture at that time as well. How does all this relate to the Rasa dance? In the Rasa dance, Krishna disappears. Krishna is absent in the Rasa dance. And this is a big problem for the gopis. But of course, the whole mood is thoroughly and completely and entirely and 100% and 200% and 1,000% different from the situation in the dicing game. But in both situations, Krishna is absent, and both situations are crucial to the particular stories. The story of Krishna's pastimes, if we want to call it story or call it history, the Rasa dance is central. I mean, everybody agrees that take Rasa dance away from 10th canto, it's not the same anymore. It's just not, you know, it's not Krishna Lila. So the rasa is in the center. Dicing game, take that away from the story of the Mahabharata. You don't have the war of Kurukshetra. And therefore you don't have Mahabharata. In both situations, Krishna's absent. That's interesting. So I explore that a little bit in this paper. Okay, what else can we say about this? It's the other theme I mentioned, it's encouraging. And Prabhupada, in his purport, wants to encourage us as devotees not to go grabbing swords and axes and guns and go out fighting, but rather to have a positive spirit in Krishna consciousness, that we want to participate in Krishna's plan. We may not know what is Krishna's plan in its entirety. In fact, nobody except Krishna knows Krishna's plan in its entirety. But as Prabhupada explains here, the plans of the devotees are as good as his plans. His meaning Krishna's. So we make plans. We can feel good. We can feel positive about them. That they are, if we are properly situated as devotees, following superior devotees, following guru, following Vaishnavas, then our plans are also good. Now someone will say, but maybe our plans don't get fulfilled in the same way Krishna's plans do. Yes, that's true, but we have to understand so many people have so many plans, and Krishna has to work them all out in some kind of, you know, perfectly connected way. When Krishna wants to create a universe, what does he do? He just breathes and out it comes. Even there, of course, Lord Brahma, he's involved, and he gets very concerned. In the second canto of Bhagavatam, he's praying to Krishna to do it right. So for him, it's a whole undertaking. What to speak of us? We want to build a temple. Oh, so much undertaking. So much time. Still, progress is there. Right? So we keep going step by step by step. And then we feel, yes, this is also part of Krishna's plan. Prabhupada says one should follow such plans and be victorious in the struggle for existence. Of course, he's kind of borrowing the expression struggle for existence from evolution theory. It's kind of this phrase is in the air. The struggle for existence is what all living entities do. According to the ideas of evolution, which they then survive, right? Who survives? Those who are fittest. Those who are best equipped. So the suggestion here is that the best way to be equipped to survive and indeed be victorious in the struggle for existence is somehow line up with Krishna's plan. Do what we can to see what is Krishna's plan and then follow that. One could at this point say, exactly, here is the rub. How to understand what is Krishna's plan. And where someone has lots of conviction that they are following Krishna's plan, someone else who is entirely 180 degrees in opposition to the first person says, no, I am following Krishna's plan. The assumption being that you can't have two people in opposition and Krishna's plan is on both sides. Right. What's our time frame? I have my watch with me. Oh, 8:25. Okay, I won't go too much longer. I was sort of thinking of shifting to this theme, but I don't know if we want to do that. Some of you maybe were attending in Radhadesh some weeks ago. Jayadvaita Swami's seminar. Any of you? Jayadvaita Swami was... No? We talked a little about this in Baltura. He gave a seminar called, in his clever sort of way, Unity and Perversity, sort of playing on the word diversity, unity and diversity. So he called it Unity and Perversity. In order to... Well, it went over several days, so we can't say very much. We can hardly touch the surface. But he was talking about, in sort of sociological terms, about the Krishna consciousness movement. There is the expression, the idea of the post-charismatic movement or movements, where you have someone who is super attractive, powerful, authoritative because of being attractive, such as Srila Prabhupada. Everyone simply follows because no one even thinks that it would be possible that he is not following Krishna's plan. To keep in connection with our theme here. At some point, and this is one of the points of Jayadvaita Swami's discussion, was we are by no means alone in this. This is a very typical thing which goes on all the time through the history of religious movements, that sooner or later the charismatic personality departs. Leaving what? Leaving a big challenge for those who have been following the, what we would say, Acharya. So he discussed a lot of history and sociology, an interesting discussion, and I would say it was, or can be helpful. There are recordings if you want to listen. They can be helpful for gaining a sense of perspective to see that some of the challenges that we have faced in our society over the last almost 30 years since Prabhupada's departure we're not alone in this. This is going on all the time. And what else is going on all the time as a consequence are various conflicts, various splits. Sometimes some union coming together again. But this being the age of Kali, it's more likely the other way that you get people disagreeing and then splitting. One of his points generally was made in the discussion after talking for a long time about schism, what sociologists analyze, how schisms happen and so on. Somebody asked, it sounds pretty unavoidable. This seems to happen. There are these... And Maharaj answered, schism is avoidable, but conflict is not. There will be conflict. There will be disagreement. There will be misunderstandings of various sorts. So, these things are a challenge. None of this is new to you. Toward the middle, I guess, of his discussion, Maharaj gave a little summary, which I thought is useful, of what he perceives as the reality, the situation sort of surrounding our society today, or having to do with our society, ISKCON today, that one should just be aware of, so that one doesn't wonder, gosh, why is it like this? So one of his points is that the situation, especially in a country now, Croatia is more like this. He was speaking more from a perspective of Western Europe, United States. But there is a kind of open market of religion. In other words, just like you go to a vegetable market and a fruit market. So there are so many stands. Everyone has their products out for sale. And everyone is competing with everyone. And you, the customer, can come along and you can, you know, look at the tomatoes, paradise, and you know, and then you can just put it back. No, I don't like. And you can wander off to the next. You are, so to speak, in control. So it's an open religion. I'm sorry, an open market of religion. And everyone is putting up their stand. And if you really want to get a sense of this, just go on the internet and go to the various websites of the various religious groups. They're all there, you know, with flashing neon lights, so to say. Here we are, we've got it. Or just go to the various websites of, you know, now it used to be there was only ISKCON. Now there are so many Gaudiya Vaishnava groups and sites, you know, websites. They're all there, kind of flashing. Here we are. So this is the situation in which we are. It's an open market. And you cannot insist to anybody, you have to buy my product. Hey, I don't want to. If I want to, I'll come. You know, that's the way it is. Another point he makes, which is a point of change from early ISKCON, and that is that grihasthas are financially independent. Far more so than was the case in the beginning. Early years, there were hardly grihasthas. And those who were, they were not financially independent. They were part of a temple scene and in Los Angeles and in Montreal. We read the grihasthas were all living in the same room, divided by curtains. So you had one grihastha couple, and then a curtain, and another grihastha couple, and a curtain. How about that? Austerity is the wealth of the brahmanas. Yes. So this, of course, has changed the situation such that grihasthas don't feel so much under the control of temples. They are not under a sort of coercive authority of ISKCON. A third point he makes is that the second generation, and one could define second generation now in different ways. Second generation can mean the children of those who are devotees, but one could also say second generation of devotees, meaning those whose gurus are disciples of Srila Prabhupada. He didn't go into this so much. I think what he meant, though, was the children of devotees, whether initiated by Prabhupada or by Prabhupada disciples, are not necessarily committed to one spiritual supplier. And here he's using the word supplier in the sense of market. So a market supplier, you know, ISKCON is a spiritual supplier, but there are so many other suppliers. And the second generation by no means feels particularly committed to ISKCON. That's just how it is. Kind of a surprise for some. And they find it difficult to, how can that be? They have to feel committed. No, they don't have to. They see a world where they have options. A fourth interesting point is that the obstacles to what he called cross-sectarian marriages have become weak. Turn that around, translate it, it means we have now several Vaishnava groups in the world, and in the marriage market, someone may feel there's not much of a choice over in this camp, of sectarian camp. There's more of a choice over here. Okay, I'm part of that camp, but hey, you know, here's somebody, a potential husband or wife, ready to go, and yeah, we get along fine. And so what if we're in different sectarian camps? Because there are other considerations. For someone who wants to be a householder, the sectarian consideration might not be the final consideration. And the final point he makes in this context, Jayadvaita Swami makes the point that the market for what ISKCON and the broader Krishna consciousness movement has to offer is very large. So what that means is that there are a lot of potential customers. So this is kind of on a positive side if one is thinking there are not so many people who are actually interested in Krishna consciousness. He's making the point, no, it's not true. There's a vast market. There are people who are interested in product of Krishna consciousness. Okay, maybe I'll stop there. We could go into other... He went through a list of positive gains in ISKCON over the last 30 years to give a positive perspective on things. And he talks about some of those things and some of the changes in that context. But I think I'll stop here, and maybe you have a question or a comment, and we can see what comes up. Yes? Urge. He was fast. Okay. Preaching to Hindus. Did everyone hear? Question? Okay. One way to understand it, I think, I don't know if it's a way to respond, but it's a way to understand the mentality, is that we have one devotee. I admit he's no longer active member of ISKCON, but he's a nice devotee, and we work with him in Oxford with one of our education projects. He has a PhD, and his doctoral study was on the Mahabharata, and he wrote a book, and his book was focused on the teachings of the Mahabharata. What is, if you put it all together, what is it actually teaching? It goes through very systematically, very nicely. And he makes the point, if you look at all of the references in the Mahabharata, and he means by Mahabharata what's sometimes called the Vulgate version, the commonly used one in India, the one that includes Krishna sending cloth to Draupadi and so on. But he says you can recognize what he calls epic monotheism. And he says, in some sections you'll find Vasudeva, Narayana, Vishnu will be eulogized as the supreme. But there are other sections where Shiva is presented as supreme. There are sections where Krishna or some form of Krishna does worship Shiva. You'll find the reverse. Sometimes you'll find Durga is praised as supreme. So it's kind of a mix, and there's no sort of clear bottom line. And you will say, well, wait a minute, but Bhagavad Gita. Well, yes, but Bhagavad Gita is 18 chapters in a huge book. And in fact, later on, Arjuna does forget these instructions. According to, he gets into trouble sometimes. But so it's this kind of vague. It's Mahabharata, so people are reading Mahabharata. That's what they're getting. It's this vague, sort of a monotheism, which does kind of shift the form. Now, some will say that comes from the Vedic hymns, because in the Vedas, Rig Veda, what do you get? You get a hymn to Indra. Oh, Indra, you are the supreme personality of Godhead. You are all-powerful. You are all-pervasive. You are all this. You are all that. Next hymn. Oh, Agni, you are the supreme personality of Godhead. Everyone surrenders unto you. Da 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 da. And on it goes like that. And the famous 19th century scholar Max Müller, bless his heart, he coined a term. Actually, I think it was already there. It's a Greek word, henotheism. Henotheism, not atheism, not deism, not pantheism, not panentheism, but henotheism, which is his word for just this, that it's a kind of merry-go-round, that the particular personality you're worshiping at the moment becomes the supreme personality. The supreme person takes that form. And I mean, there is some sense of that even in the Gita, especially in the 10th chapter, where Krishna is talking about his opulences when he says, you know, of the Rudras, I am Shiva, etc., etc., etc. So you can understand where that's coming from. Then there are the Puranas, and you have a Shiva Purana, you have a Brahma Purana and so on, in which one particular personality is praised as the supreme. And then you can throw up your hands and say, well, gosh, you know, actually the Hindus got it right. It is this kind of vague, epic monotheism, and we just have to be happy with that. Or you can decide, well, if I'm going to understand the ultimate truth, I have to take shelter of Acharya, and that's what we do. And then we find out that Jiva Goswami goes through this exercise, the Tattva Sandarbha, and he concludes the most authoritative scripture, Pramana, is the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the Srimad Bhagavatam is quite clear. Krishna is too Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's a kind of a choice we make, in a way. But I would say that when preaching to, preaching with, discussing with, talking with Indians, one should be a little careful. One shouldn't try to ram down their throats. I mean, it depends on the situation. If you are feeling empowered, you may be convincing to say, try to understand Krishna's words in Bhagavad Gita. You're allowing yourself to avoid surrendering to the Supreme Lord by thinking in this way. There are so many divinities, so many demigods. Krishna does make it clear in the Gita there is a higher understanding. Bahunam janmanam ante jnanamang man prapadyate Vasudeva Sarvam Iti. And that will qualify you to do the real thing, which is surrendering to the Lord. Fact is, now you're glibly saying there are so many gods and so on, but you're not surrendering. So you may be able to, you know, corner someone and they will listen. But more often than not, you will simply alienate them. Those Hare Krishnas, they are simply fanatics. So you have to be a little careful. You can be clear. You can say, you know, we understand that there is one Supreme Lord and his name is Krishna. You may have your many gods, but this is our understanding. And you can just be unequivocal in that way. You don't have to compromise. But one has to also be a little sensitive how to relate with Indians, especially. They also have deep conviction, you know. It's not just that they... well, some of them, of course, they're just seeing the Bollywood videos, and that's how they get their understanding of Hinduism. But still, there are others who... have their convictions. Yeah. Well, I think the general understanding is that Krishna is fulfilling everyone's desire and he is in fact validating, he's supporting. You want to worship Shiva? Yes, I also worship Shiva. Krishna is not so simple. And you know, there will be some story I would it would be beyond me at the moment to remember the story of why it is that Krishna worships Shiva at a particular point, but it will be a compelling reason somehow. So Rama worships Shiva at Rameshwaram after the battle at Lanka. He comes back, and in order to perform prayaschitta, I believe, he worships Shiva. And then you have the Rameshwaram temple, in which the Shivalinga is the main figure, object of worship. But in the same temple, there are Sitaram, Lakshman, Hanuman, I guess, deities, and both Vaishnavas and Shaivites come to the temple. So it's actually kind of nice in one sense. You see the two different sects coming together. They both worship in the same temple. Yes, David, you had. Well, it's a good point. I'm not a Mahabharata scholar, so I don't know what if there's any mention of others, Brahmins. Certainly it was Kshatriyas who were fighting, and it was the Sutas who were with their driving the chariots. Yeah.
There was actually an army which was serving Pandavas, an army was serving with others.
Right.
The fight is something that the cook came and we whatever.
Uh-huh.
They just went to home after that.
They went home.
Yeah.
Okay, so somebody was left.
There were thousands of
them. Yeah. Yeah. But I think Yudhishthira's feeling was everybody's gone, because Yudhishthira was, you know, to be a king means to be the king of other Kshatriyas also, not just Shudras and Vaishyas. So maybe in that sense he was all alone. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Well, that's an interesting question. Off the top of my head, I would say that if we wanted to compare them all, then we would say the one he showed to Duryodhana was a srishti. The one he's showing here is a pralaya or a nirodha. And the one he's showing to Mother Yashoda is, what's the Sanskrit word we want, is maintenance. It's because if you read the description, it's just a description. There's this universe, and there's so many different manifestations in the universe, and it's all just there, isn't it? I don't remember hearing in that section about destruction or creation so much. It's more like just a description of the many planets and stars, and you know, Mother Yashoda is just seeing all these wonderful things, and including herself, she looks in and, hey, that's me. And there's Nanda. And then she just shakes her head. Wait a minute. What is this? right? So it's, yeah, that's an interesting point. It's maintenance. Maybe I should write that in my paper. No, I don't have any more time. This paper I have to read is 20 minutes. I get 20 minutes to read, and then there's 10 minutes for discussion, and then that's it. Oh, the next paper, a very strict time schedule. Yes. Why Krishna's missing? Krishna's missing because there is, in the Bhagavatam, of course, Krishna himself is explaining, I disappear so that in order to increase the love of my devotees. Why is he absent in the dice game? So that the whole Mahabharata, so that the battle can eventually happen, because it's also, it's his plan. That's the same thing here, saying it's his plan. It's everybody's got to go, and this was all just part of his setting up the pieces, so to say. Yeah. So sometimes we may feel, oh, Krishna is, where are you, Krishna? Krishna in his absence is making things happen. Yes, sir. You mean, not sure I'm quite getting this. You're talking about co-wives of a king who have no children? Maidservants. Well, I guess the question is, you're asking what about them, and I can only ask, yeah, what about them? Well, sometimes they will be quite dissatisfied in that case. Gandhari was very, very, very disturbed when Kunti gave birth. Kunti? Madri? Kunti. Yeah, Kunti gave birth, and then Gandhari, who was pregnant, was so angry, frustrated, she forced premature birth, so to say. And then came this big lump, and so on. And then it was Vyasadeva who divided up into 100 parts. Yeah. Interesting story. Vyasa's position, his involvement in the Mahabharata is very intriguing. Very intriguing, because he's simultaneously outside telling the story, and he's in the story making things happen. And it's quite interesting what goes on. So there you have it. Okay, we'll sort of stop there. Well, there is this translation series that's been going on for years in India. You know, these, some of you have seen the sort of green volumes. They've got lots and lots of Puranas translated, and they're still working on them in English. The translation style is pretty horrible. I mean, it's really pretty dry English. I mean, really dry. I mean, oh, sometimes it's painful. But they're good as reference books. You just want to know what happened and don't care too much about the language. Recommend, what to recommend for such people? It's hard. Recommend Krishna book. Prabhupada encouraged people to read Krishna book. And what else can they read? Well, Skanda Purana, if they can find some translation. Skanda Purana has the story of Jagannath in it. Even though Skanda Purana is considered by Jiva, I believe, to be for those in the mode of ignorance. But which, you know, that's another whole story. Which Skanda Purana, which Padma Purana, which, because there are so many versions. Therefore also Jiva Goswami said Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavata Purana, because you don't get lots of different versions there. With minor differences, they're all the same. Same with Bhagavad Gita. So many versions of Mahabharata, but Bhagavad Gita, practically, very tiny differences. Same. Okay. Some of you are having a long drive tonight. Thank you all very much. It's been fun. Bhagavad Gita as it is. Ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Premanande.